Now, you're going to meet two farmers from opposite sides of the country who are turning their back on what they call factory farming. Jeff Powell is from WA, and Tammy Jonas, you might remember. Tammy's from Victoria. And we met Tammy last year during our Wilbur 101 project. Both of these farmers say they're raising livestock in what they believe is a more ethical way. Now they're taking the next step in the production process, butchering their animals on their farm rather than sending the animals to large meatworks factories. To find out why, I've got Jeff Powell and Tammy Jonas with me now. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good. Tammy, thanks for coming in again. Nice to see you again. Jeff, I'll start with you. Tell us about your farm.
Southampton Homestead is a little farm tucked away in the southwest of Western Australia. We're in, I suppose, regionally sort of high country, but on the banks of the Blackwood River system. We were fortunate to pick up the farm about 8 years ago. The buildings were 1860, triple heritage listed old farmhouse buildings. But the pastures themselves were quite degraded and had been under pine for about 30 or 40 years. So, it was a sort of a journey back from the brink for the pastures to kickstart that again, I suppose. Brings it to our motto, which is we see ourselves primarily as grass-powered. We're grass farmers.
And what do you farm with all that grass?
The principle that we actually farm by is called holistic management, founded by Alan Savory about 30 years ago from the Savory Institute. And what we do is we use ruminants to drive the recovery process of the pasture grasses and aim to build a biodiverse pasture, so as many varieties as we can per square metre for a whole range of different reasons, but basically believing that the diversity of the soil ecology matches the diversity of the gut flora in animals. But we use those ruminants, those sheep and cows, to drive our pastured poultry industry. So putting pastured poultry, chickens and Muscovy ducks.
Okay, so you tend to sell poultry, more or less.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's the
Tammy, remind us of your property, where you are and what you got there.
Yep, we're at Eganstown, just outside of Daylesford, Victoria, also high country. And we have a small herd of free-range, large black, rare breed pigs and an even smaller herd of low-lying cattle. So we do pork and beef.
Mm-hmm. And people would remember Wilbur from last year. Can you recap what that was and how that affected you?
Yeah, the Wilbur project was really interesting for us because we call ourselves radically transparent, which is we think farms generally should be transparent. But we've gone to the further extent of, you know, going on national radio and talking to you, Cam, about whether we should castrate a pig and whether we should slaughter a pig and whether we should eat a pig. Totally uncontroversial topics, of course. So following Wilbur from birth to plate was a really interesting project for us.
And what, in the wash-up, you know, several months down the track, generally, how would you describe the response to that project?
I would say overwhelmingly positive. I think there was a very vocal group of vegan abolitionists who did not respond as positively, but they were certainly not the majority. Most people thought it was great to hear us detail our systems and ask people for their views about whether what we were doing was in fact as ethical as we suggested it is.
Okay. One of the issues we touched on last year when we were discussing Wilbur was the transportation to an abattoir and how far you had to transport the animals. Jeff, I imagine this has been an issue for you in the past as well. How far away is your closest abattoir?
It's actually 300 kilometres away to the north in northern suburbs of Perth. So it's a significant distance, and of course that introduces both a degree of expense, so time from the farm, money and actually transporting the animals, and then of course you've got the cost of somebody else actually processing them. So
if you have to transport a bird 300 kilometres to be slaughtered, what would it cost you?
In actual economic terms, it doesn't work. So the cost of actual processing at the abattoir I mentioned was $8 an animal. So when you talk about some of your factory farmed animals that you see in Coles supermarkets, for example, you pay $10 for a whole chicken. So you add the cost of feeding the birds.
Killing it is the $8.
Correct.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So it doesn't make sense, does it? Well, you'd have to be...
No. Yeah. So thus our... I suppose I got quite indignant when I really began to look at the economics of it, like many of my peers, including Tammy. It's like, this is heritage. You know, I think it's our right to be able to farm animals and to do that in an on-farm way. And I suppose there's a level of intimacy there as well, both with your animals and your customers. So we were, you know, if that's a right, then how do we go about doing it? And trying to manage the different costs. So you talk about input costs, you've got cost of feed, you've got the cost of actually processing the animals, and the cost of breeding the animals. And so what could we control and what could we bring back on farm and just reintegrate that value chain and remove some of these middlemen? And the other big cost, of course, is getting them to the customers. And we just thought, you know, we're going direct. And that's just been really successful. So, and I think it's our right to be able to run profitable businesses as well. And that's how this model actually works. And if you like, the larger you take this kind of a model, the more it breaks down. And so in this case, I'd coin a phrase from an old book written by Schumacher about 30 years ago: small is beautiful. We have minimal problems as far as impacts on the environment from, you know, processing the birds on site. All the waste are composted and recycled, and pretty much most of the animal is actually used anyway.
So processing on site, that means killing them on the farm. This is something a lot of farmers want to do but can't. How have you gone about it?
Well, I decided that's what I wanted to do, and I decided to go benchmarking. And so I went to the UK. I looked at a lot of the I suppose what you call paddock to plate or farm to plate enterprises over in the UK, and then I travelled the United States and looked at some best practice. I mean, Joel Salatin and the Polyface Farms organisation and the network of the Riggrarians here in Australia and internationally. And there are models in how you should do that. And so I then drafted my own plans. I put in a development application, and you wouldn't believe that a micro abattoir showed up in the Trading Post. and to coin a phrase from the castle, how much was he asking?
Yeah.
it was up in Cairns, been built
by so not locally?
No, exactly. So I don't know if anyone's done the Perth to Cairns run. It's brutal. And I jumped on an aircraft, went straight up, had a look, and I bought it on the spot. It was exactly what we were looking for. Small, compact, professionally, completely fitted to meet the Australian New Zealand food standards. And stuck it on the back of a truck and bought it back. So it just matched exactly the plans that I had drawn. And so our development is in with the council at the moment, and the town planner is very happy. And as far as I know, we've met all the requirements and going forward for approval.
So this means you will legally be able to sell the product the animals that you slaughter yourself on the farm?
Yeah, so the next hurdle, of course, is accreditation through the authorities, the state health authorities, so the health department, etc. But we've already, we're at the stage of completing our environment management plan and also our food standards guide for the machinery and the equipment. So, but that with those, I suppose, ticks in the box, we would hope and expect that we would be ready to be harvesting in the spring. So, and taking those directly to market to Leaderville and Subiaco.
Tammy, you've looked at doing this on your property, slaughtering on farm, and it's been difficult. Why? What have been the impediments?
Well, for us, I mean, pigs and cattle, of course, are much larger animals, so the facility requirement is higher. It would be more expensive. Having said that, I mean, we crowdfunded a butcher's shop, so we could probably get an abattoir up if we really wanted to. Mm. The other, and obviously a lot more work if you're doing the slaughtering, and we already work, I think it's 17 days a week, so I'm not sure where we would find the slaughtering day.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, I was going to ask Jeff about, I think you have to have a meat inspector at every abattoir. So one of us would actually have to go and become a meat inspector. Is that right, Jeff?
We've got some regional inspectors. I know there's, for example, there's one based in Albany, and I'm assuming there's one based in Bunbury as well, because there are two regional large animal abattoirs in Bunbury in the southwest. So, but that is definitely a challenge. Mm. I think for the government and for the state level authorities is how to then resource if we have an emerging trend of many micro abattoirs. What does that mean as far as a regulatory policing, if you like.
Because so, it does raise legitimate food safety questions if you have more and more people with small-scale abattoirs killing animals in around the countryside.
Yeah, we don't want to go back to a time when, you know, a lot of people got sick from bad food processing.
I'd even make the comment that, but in this type of model where you clearly meet the standards, and also with a pastured and a small-scale environment, your actual generation of those pathogens is less to
Absolutely.
The point where it becomes undetectable because you're in an environment that's not industrial. You're in an environment that it's not intensive. So you actually don't get the effluents and all the other wastes that are large industrial plants are trying to deal with. And therefore, the risk of contamination is much higher in those larger plants.
I've heard also, there's clearly a consumer demand for this sort of product, whether it's mainstream or not, you can argue about, but there is people that are willing to pay for it. I've heard all sorts of stories. Tell me about farmers that will sell a share in a live animal to the local community so that then if it's killed on the farm, they are allowed to, it's not technically sell it, but at least give the person their meat back. There's little loopholes. There's ways people try to get around this, isn't there?
Yeah, and there are quite a few herd shares have cropped up across Australia to deal with that part of the regulation. And there's the case in South Australia of the raw milk dairy where the people own part of the herd, which is why they can have the raw milk. Mm. But the government's been trying to prosecute them. And it's outrageous. I mean, you have these people who understand the risks and benefits of raw milk and they want it. And the government's saying, oh, that's too dangerous. It's outrageous.
The basic argument is, though, you're not allowed to buy or sell raw milk, but you are allowed to own a cow and do what you want with it within
exactly.
reason.
That's right.
Okay, and that's how people try to get around this, which is it does seem a fairly strange situation that that's what's happening, but I guess there's the regulatory arguments for why this takes place. I'm chatting here with Tammy Jonas, free-range pork producer from Jonai Farms in the northwest of Melbourne, and also Jeff Powell, who's from Western Australia and has a micro abattoir, mobile micro abattoir, on the property, and is involved in poultry farming. Tammy, so you haven't been able to go down the abattoir route, but you have gone down the boning room or becoming a butcher. Tell me what you've developed on the property.
Yeah, so for a lot of the reasons that Jeff outlined, you know, taking control of that process back on the farm for reasons of transparency, reliability of being able to get the butchering done, and importantly, profitability. You know, about 40% of our margin was going to butchering before we built our own butcher shop.
40%? 40%. To cut the animal up? Wow.
Yeah. It was about $200 a pig to cut up a pig. Whereas it's $30 to have them slaughtered. So it's a huge amount of how much we could take in then.
Yeah.
And now we've done the numbers after running it for 6 months, and we've gone from about 40% of our margin to about 11% of our margin, including direct costs and overheads.
But you had to learn to become a butcher.
Correct. I'm a butcher now.
How'd you do that?
I had a wonderful butcher who was as crazy as we are and said that I could cut with him and learn with him. So I went in every fortnight and cut up our pigs with him for 6 months until I knew the trade.
And Jeff, I take it you had to learn to slaughter poultry.
I have. I actually have an ex-corporate background, so it was...
And I'm a former academic, Jeff, so I'm with you.
That's right. It was... And to a crazy extent, YouTube is your friend, you know, in trying
so
to understand.
True.
There are so many great people who have tricks of the trade, if you like, and they've put them online in explicit detail on how to actually... you know, break down an animal into the correct pieces, etc. And so, yeah, there I am with my Mac on one side of me and the other side, you know, a knife and the animal that I'm
So let me just make sure I understand this right. You buy yourself an abattoir from the trading post on the other side of the continent, bring it back, tow it back to your farm, then open up YouTube and search how to kill a chook. Is that what happened?
Of course, the journey's actually about 7 years long. So with both mentor, like Tammy mentioned, some fantastic mentors, especially when you're talking about the handling of the animals. I mean, the animals that we raise, we adore, you know, and so the care and the very, very careful, you know, euthanizing of those animals prior to their their processing is an important stage. And I'll drop in a bit of a fringe perspective on this, but it's a little bit it's a sacred stage because these animals their lives are being given up so that we can survive and eat and be nourished. So the importance of bringing that back onto the farm, I think it's just an important point in the whole conversation that these are animals that we birthed, these are animals that we raised, and then these are animals whose lives we took so that we could feed the community. So I think this is a level that's not transactional. It's actually, it's a slight element that's spiritual. So,
but how do you actually do it, Jeff? Jeff, what's the process?
Do you mean to...
The slaughtering process?
Yeah, so, well, two stages. One is the stunning of the animal. So that's either electrical or a device that breaks the vertebrae, so breaks their neck. And then they're placed into a cone that inverts them and a small incision to the carotid artery, and then they bleed out. So they're dead instantly, or stunned or dead instantly, and then, they bleed out. And then that process, within a couple of minutes, they're, you know, into scalding and defeathering and then into the processing room. So all up, we're talking about 10 to 11 minutes to process an entire bird.
Mm. Jeff, you mentioned Joel Sellerton, and Tammy, I was speaking to you about Joel before. Of if some people know him as the lunatic farmer or from Polyface Farms.
Well, he calls himself that.
Yes, that's his term, not mine. So you're both disciples of Joel Sellerton? Is that too strong?
Yeah. Even go on, Tammy.
Yeah, I mean, I always find disciple a little bit, I don't know, religious, but absolutely.
We're just talking about the spiritual side of all.
No, but
of
I
this,
think so. Definitely Joel Sellerton is a fantastic leader for so many of us, and has had more impact on modern farming than sort of anybody else. Mm.
But how much more advanced, if you like, is this movement, this trend in the United States than it is here in Australia?
I would say far further advanced. Before we set up on our farm, we spent 4 months driving across America and visiting a number of these kinds of farms to see how it was done and what the realities were before we took it up. And they're everywhere. The kind of fair food movement in America is already well and truly underway. It's also combating a much kind of more entrenched industrial food system than perhaps we are.
Mm. Well, and even if I mentioned to the point that... there's organisations like the Farm to Consumer Legal Defence Fund as well that's been set up nationally by farmers and their advocates to actually protect and defend farmers' their rights in processing animals this way as well, and also protecting the community's rights.
Mm. Well, it certainly seems that consumers, like consumers in the US, are asking maybe more questions about the origins of their food and their meat in particular than we're hearing here in Australia. There was quite an amusing take on this from the satirical television show Portlandia.
Right, so here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great.
He looks like a happy little guy who runs around.
A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like... You know, palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
And you have a good relationship with this farm?
We do.
But it's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami
who's
just saying that he's organic.
It tears at the core of my being, the idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type, no.
Tell you what, we're going to go check it out if you don't mind, just if you could hold our seats.
Oh, now?
Yeah, I won't be right back. Just want to make sure.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
So that's Portlandia's, you'd have to say, amusing take on the ethical locavore, I guess. And you're both laughing there. So, Tammy, you don't see that as people mocking what you do?
It's absolutely mocking what we do it all the time. And actually, when I'm speaking in public about how to choose where you buy your meat, I always say don't eat a chicken unless you know its name was Colin.
Yeah, but the... so you're embracing it. But there is this criticism that small-scale livestock production, it's not efficient, it's not resource-efficient, it can't feed the world. It seems to be an argument that's been going around in circles now for a few years. There is some truth, some merit in that argument, isn't there?
I don't know that I would agree with that, Cameron. I mean, first of all, whose interest is it serving to suggest that we can't feed the world the way that we are, the way that Jeff and I are? And second of all, I think industrial food is not feeding the world, actually. We have, you know, loads of people who are going hungry when there's plenty of food around, not getting it to people. I think small-scale agriculture across the world feeds 70% of the world. And so here we have these, you know, monolithic kind of farming systems that are actually not feeding that many people, in truth.
But to come back to the Portlandia clip, Jeff, is it really going to get to that level of almost absurd consumer concern? Where does it stop?
Look, I think knowing the farm and knowing the farmer, is a level of intimacy that people are looking for, that assurance, because in a sense the industrial farm system has betrayed people's trust. It's betrayed people's trust because the food we've discovered is not as nourishing, and in some cases it's toxic. So toxic to the animals, toxic to the environment where they're being raised because of the intensity. When you look at feedlot operations and chicken and pig factories, I mean, that is a betrayal of people's trust, because that's not a farm.
You've opened a can of worms there, Jeff, that we'll have to take you up on another day, I think. There's a lot more to talk about. But thank you for coming in and joining us today. It's been great to chat. Yes, Jeff Powell, free-range poultry producer just south of Perth, or 300 kilometres south of Perth, and Tammy Jonas, free-range pork producer from just near Daylesford.